Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Carl Carlson.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Hey, Carl. You know, I mentioned the other day that we got a speak pipe. I think I was on the recording with Kirk, and I wanted it to be when you're here because it's from Keith, and it's not really a question, so it's not going to kick off an episode for us, but it was a pretty nice message, and I wanted to just play it. And let's give that a listen, and then we'll get into today's topic.
Hi, Fred. This is Keith Fong in El Paso, Texas. And speaking of reliability, episode 707, you posed the question, is there a better way than RPN? And I think the answer is unequivocally yes, because risk priority number is to risk assessment as mean time between failure is to reliability prediction. It's worse than meaningless because it's driving bad behaviors, which you and Carl discuss in the episode. The individual categories of severity, occurrence, and detection are really valuable in their assessments. Multiplying them does not make arithmetic sense because first, you have to assume that each of the categories is equally valuable, and that's not true. We consider severity more important than, say, detection. The other thing is, these numbers we use are rankings. So a risk of 3 is not half the risk of 6, it's not 1/3 the risk of 9. So I think the AIAG action priority matrix is a pretty good way of approaching this because all 3 categories are preserved in their full range, and then you can better assess how severe your risk is. So thanks, Fred. I appreciate it.
All right. And that was Keith with a speak pipe recording. You can find that over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And you can leave us a voice message, as we've said now for a few episodes anyway. But it works. And hopefully, and we really appreciate the comments, even if it's not really a question, but it's good to know that somebody's listening and that we're on the right track anyway.
Very cool. Say, hey, Fred, I was looking at this, you know, we're writing this book and it's coming along nicely and I'm really happy with where it's going. And we can see the light at the end of the tunnel, to use that metaphor. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking about reliability plans. And a while back, I did a reliability plan for a client that was different. And I was contemplating whether the 6-step process we have fits for it. So let me introduce the topic, and then I'd be interested in your views, and I'll share my views and a story or two on it. Okay. This is a reliability plan that was specifically commissioned to set up and get operational a reliability organization. And that's not unusual because in many companies, you know, you could have a company that's a startup and then starts to get more mature, mm-hmm. and maybe they hire reliability support from the outside, but it's time to set up the organization a little more with substance. Or you could have a company that is a larger company and has a small reliability group, but they really want to broaden it out and be able to take on more methods in-house rather than bringing in outside people. And so do the same 6 steps that we have, and I'll put those in the show notes. Do they apply as well to setting up a reliability organization? And a few years ago, I did this reliability plan that was exactly that. And just to share a 60-second summary, we did a strategic vision, just like step 1. Mm-hmm. And in that, I set up meetings with the different directors and VPs to say, you know, what's your vision for reliability? Where do you want to be in 1 year, 3 years, 5 years? And also engineering teams. And I got a good sense for where this organization wanted to be. We plotted where they are today and where they want to be on the maturity matrix, mm-hmm. which I can also put a link to on the show notes. And then we did a really good gap analysis on where are they today compared to where they want to be. Mm-hmm. And we came up with a summarized, prioritized list of gaps and then turned it into a plan. But what was interesting is that each of plan steps we organized into year one, and then year two and three, and then year four and five. So the rollout of the organization did not overwhelm resources, and we could prioritize where we put our first year's efforts, and then keeping the first year in place, in other words, don't drop out anything, but then where we put year two and three and four and five. So I just wanted to share that with the listeners and with you, Fred, that the six-step process we talk about works really well for setting up a reliability organization as well as accomplishing reliability on a product.
One of our early discussions, wasn't it, are we talking about creating a plan for a project, for a specific thing, item that we want to design and develop and sell, or is it for the organization to be able to support many projects? And the hard part for me is that they're so interrelated, you know. So, I've been asked to help an organization at a corporate level figure it out. And it was kind of what I was working on when I was at Hewlett Packard. I wasn't as conscious of, you know, what's the vision? What are the steps? It was, and I've done this more often where it's opportunistic. I might be commissioned to help a program or a team develop a plan for their specific project, right? Yet it intermingles with how the overall larger organization has their infrastructure, has their thought process, all their decisions, and so on. So I've always muddled them more than I think the opportunity like you had.
Well, yeah, and I agree with you on this, because on the vast majority of my reliability plans, it includes organizational as well as specific project-related tasks. And so I do commingle them. In fact, I even separate them out in the plan where I'll have, here's some organizational tasks that we need to do, or sometimes they're mingled right in to the project tasks, because in order to do this, we have to send someone for training to build the capability. And so I think they are commingled. And that's what I really wanted to talk over, is that the steps, the six steps, work very well, regardless of whether you're implementing a particular project. In other words, you're hitting the ground running on the widget project to achieve your reliability objectives, or you've been commissioned to set up a reliability organization, or any combination of those, you follow the same six steps, and really the plan can embrace both.
Well, there's been a couple of times I've been asked to help set up a lab, and it's really just, and I've also been asked to help people set up their consultancy. And I'm thinking it would work in both those, you know, what are you trying to achieve? What are you trying to accomplish? What are you trying to measure? What are you offering? Those kind of vision type questions. And then the gap analysis, well, do you have space? Do you have the skills? Do you have the background? Do you have the experience? Do you have the technical know-how to run this equipment and so on? I think it comes to my mind, Carl, is that the six-step plan is not unique. I think we both come up with something similar because of it. It's so practical. It's not uncommon to figure out where you're going and then
yes,
what do you need to do and then go sort it out. So I don't think there's anything magical that it works at both, you know, at a corporate level or at an enterprise level or at a project level. I think it's a good practical approach for all kinds of different projects. And I wouldn't limit it to just reliability. Now, we tend to do the gap analysis about, well, what's your reliability vision and what do you need to do to get there? We slant it that way, but it could also be, you know, what's your profit targets and how are you going to get there? The lots of different things would fit into it. So I think part of it is that it is pretty practical, I think is the best word for it.
Yes, it is. The It's not my first principles on the subject go back to Stephen Covey and probably earlier than that. Mm-hmm. But Covey talks about begin with the end in mind. And there's so many other things in his writings that fit that. Mm-hmm. But clearly the concept of starting with a vision or where you want to be has got to go back a long ways. And so we're borrowing knowledge from other bodies, other literature and other practices. I agree, that's why it works. I want to say something else about the organizational plan. And like you say, it fits, it commingles, it fits right into the reliability plan, is that even if you're tasked with setting up an organization, the best way to do it, in my opinion, is not just to hire people and then train them and then you think you're done.
You set up a lab over in the corner of the building and hope everybody gets better. No.
Hope everybody can make it there. Yeah. The best way to do it is to align it with an actual project that's emerging or is underway and say, okay, we're going to hire a couple people. I'm going to train them in HALT. I'm going to train them in FMEA. And by the way, here's the projects that we're going to need to do on Project X. So they're going to do this HALT project and this FMEA project. And then we're going to review how well they did. And then we're going to see, I think the doing has to be in parallel with the burgeoning capability. Otherwise, you end up with people standing around or they don't really get the on-the-job experience that they need.
Well, it brings up a point, though, is when you – I've always – not always, I suppose, but I have not found that setting up a separate reliability team or a designated reliability team is an answer. I don't think – that's the only way that you can set it up. And I've seen that with client after client. They says, we need a reliability person. All right. Really? To do what? what is it that you're trying to accomplish? And if it's somebody to bring in expertise and depth of knowledge and the processes to enable the rest of the organization to do what they should be doing. No, I actually ran into it in an interview once. I was interviewing for a reliability engineering position, and the hiring manager was the first guy I chatted with, and he goes, now, what would you do if you had this job? And I says, well, I'd go talk to the development team. Well, no, you're not allowed to talk to the development team.
Oh, no.
Right? And I said, well, what do you need a reliability engineer for? Well, I need you to run tests and then tell us that it's working. I says, all right, no, this is a waste of time. You will not be successful with that outlook. And so I'm not going to waste the rest of your team's time. And I know some of them and send my greetings to them, but, sorry, this is not going to work. and he was thrown back in his chair. He's like, what? And of course, their product came out about a year later and it flopped horribly. I'm like,
of course,
come on, it's not separate. And the point is that when you're developing a plan for the organization or even a project, it's how do you alter the thinking of the people that are the ones creating this product or this information? How do you alter the culture? And so when you mentioned early on the maturity matrix is not the sole ownership and activity of the reliability team or reliability person. It's the organization's behavior.
You're precisely right. And I could not agree more. And this is important for listeners to understand where Fred and I are coming from here, is we're not saying a reliability organization is a separate organization. This is how you imbue or infuse reliability into the larger engineering organization. And so, yes, there might be a reliability manager or engineer, but a lot of that work is to get the other people to integrate reliability into their work projects, into their day-to-day existence, so you can design in reliability to products, to processes, design in maintenance or achieve maintainability. And that is not done by hiring a bunch of people that only sit in a reliability group and don't commingle. It's done by the interaction and getting the actual organization itself, the engineering organization, to accomplish reliability. And of course, they're going to also have to accomplish safety. They're going to accomplish quality, all the other illities. And just a look ahead, I won't share too much of this because I've just finished writing the article, but Fred, you introduced me to Greg Hutchins and the Future of Work project, which is a fantastic project that Greg works on. And so I've written the article called The Future of Reliability Engineering. And I'll just share this one little tidbit because I don't want to overlap the article itself. Because I'm pretty excited about it because there's a lot to the future of reliability engineering. But I start off with the story early on in my career when I picked up a reliability group in a large company. And I started talking to the employees, obviously, that were there. And part of my idea of the a manager's role is guidance and career. And so the employee asked me, what are the future prospects for reliability engineering? And I, after talking a little bit, I said, let me summarize this. You should try to work yourself out of a job. But he looked quizzical look. And then of course my article explains what I meant by that. But the concept is we need to get other people doing reliability as part of their work. We have to influence the organization. And that is a really important point because reliability is not done by somebody down the hallway somewhere. It's done by an organization.
Yeah, and it reminds me, one client I had, there was a manager that was, he was put in charge of improving the reliability of their products. And he had a team of five engineers, and they were, by and large, they were quality engineers. And they had various titles, but they worked more like quality engineers. They're doing process control stuff. They were doing tests to evaluate where were they meeting the specifications. They were doing stuff like that. And they were essentially a separate entity. Design team did their thing. The manufacturing team did their thing. And they kind of poked around the edges and measured stuff. They had a lab and, you know, so they didn't get invited to team meetings they didn't get invited to talk about concepts or how we're going to achieve it or where the decisions were made. They were asked, is it good? A lot of times. And so this manager was recognized that's not how we can change the reliability. We can't just start measuring more things or different things. One, we don't know how to run a decent accelerated test or negotiate for the team to conduct an FMEA. These guys would have just gone off and done it separately, you know, and did their FMEA and then try to influence the team to fix something that they weren't part of. So he recognized that wasn't going to work. And so the project was not to set up a program, but to change the mindset of that group. And he wanted them, he recognized that they needed credibility in order to have influence and to be part of the development team. And so he said, well, you can come meet these guys, but I don't want you to be the face of this change. So we met on phone a couple times a week, and we talked technique and tactics, and we did a bunch of training. And then there was the strategy parts. And they were all working on separate projects and starting to get themselves introduced to the different teams. And it was really looking for how do I help them each recognize the opportunity to influence their team? And what can they provide that adds value such they build credibility? And it was really the way this guy called it was, I want you to be the invisible hand to get our folks up to speed so that they become the face of the reliability program. And through that process, it was, how do they influence the rest of the organization? And that was a lot of fun.
That sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds like a meaningful, I mean, job satisfaction comes from doing meaningful work, and that certainly has more meaning.
Yeah. And there's a handful of those. There's a couple of those folks that are still in touch. They're in different organizations now running their own programs. And so I think it had a lot of impact. That was pretty cool. But and I've also told the story many times of this upstairs, downstairs group. where upstairs, Maude Bell basically taught the organization how to do reliability. And then at some point she said, all right, my job, my work here is done. You guys have it. You know, keep doing what you're doing. Here's my phone number if you got any questions. And she went off to a different organization to do something similar, to help them improve their program. And downstairs... Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it's like, you know this very well. It's like creating a garden where you plant the seeds, you nurture, and then you go off and do something. But you come back eventually to mm-hmm. make sure things are growing okay and take care of the weeds.
Well, chase away the squirrels in my garden.
Squirrels. Fred, I had a story to tell, if I could just jump in on for a second.
Sure.
That fits right into what you're saying. Years ago, I'm thinking back to the early 90s when I was had picked up GM's reliability, product reliability group. We didn't see enough activity going on. I say we. I had a really good engineering director who was like a mentor to me, and very, very advocate, high advocate of reliability methods. And we, meaning he and I, didn't see the culture in the engineering organizations where we wanted it to be. They just did designs the way they've always done them. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of good in that because that brings in tribal knowledge. But reliability was not part of the process. So he and I went to each of the directors and their staff meetings. And we just went one after the other, must have been 12 of them, and scheduled time. And then we presented, mostly I presented, a reliability process, a very simple process of how you achieve reliability inside the engineering organization. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget that because those little forays, those little ventures created seeds and created a slow but steady culture change because we went and revisited with them to a point where it created a pull rather than a push.
Yep.
So that was just... a side story that occurred years ago. The other comment I wanted to make is the commingling. Is when I had reliability engineers that reported to me, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Let's have you go sit on different product teams, mm-hmm. commingle with them. So I had a Corvette reliability manager, we call it, and a Buick Regal or whatever the program was that was right. going. And they would sit there with the teams, attend the meetings, and then once a week they would attend like a half-hour staff meeting with me. But that's the only time they saw me, mm-hmm. Because other than that, they were actually part of the team itself.
Right.
So I just wanted to share those stories with you.
Well, there's a handful of different ways to go about doing it. I think the main point is that it is possible to create a reliability organization. And when we say organization, it's not a new silo. It's not a spin-off of the quality team, for example, that's separate. No, it's the organization. It's how, what's considered, what information is available, how questions are asked, how decisions are made across the organization. And part of the plan to do that is how are you going to influence these folks? How are you going to create those that culture. And I think that's the key point to it. In the process of doing it, whether it's for a specific project or for the overall organization, it's still pretty basic. Common sense, I should say, or practical. Where are you trying to get? And what's in the way? What are the elements that you need to improve or fix or alter or adjust? And then keep working towards that and look for opportunities to make improvements, add value, and repeat. What do they call it? Rinse and repeat.
Rinse and repeat. Yes. Yeah. Well, so if you're listening to this and you have your own stories to tell or questions that you want us to answer or even topics for future podcasts, please get in touch and share your ideas, your questions, and thoughts.
Yep. And like we started off with the show, you can do that on a voicemail. Basically, it's a SpeakPipe widget and allows you to record up to about 90 seconds, I think is what it caps off at, and get an email that says, hey, somebody left you a message, and we might just play it on the air with one of, and if it's a good question, which I suspect many of you have good questions or quick story, might spark a whole idea for a podcast. Now, of course, you can get a hold of us also in written form. There's a contact form there. There's also Carl and I and the other hosts are available on LinkedIn or on our About pages. There's lots of ways for you to join the conversation. And we'd love to have you do so. So we look forward to that. So with that, Carl, I think my cat's looking at me like, are you going to open the door? I need to get out of here. So I better get moving.
Time to move on.
That's right. All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.